Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Karen Brown. Thanks for checking out the Mississippi Edition podcast. If you like what you hear, click subscribe, hit like, or leave us a comment if your app has that feature. Then find other MPB podcasts by searching MPB Think Radio on your favorite podcasting platform. Thanks. Good morning. It's 8:30 on Thursday, November 4th. I'm Karen Brown, and this is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, education leaders wrestle with the state's intensifying teacher shortage. Then, Mississippi artist Walter Anderson is the subject of a new TV documentary. Plus, most Gulf Coast teenagers still aren't vaccinated against COVID-19. And writer Mark A. Johnson tells us about his new book on political spectacle in the Jim Crow South. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. K-12 educators and administrators from across the state will meet today at William Carey University to discuss one of Mississippi's most troubling labor issues, an intensifying teacher shortage. Gulfport School District Superintendent Glenn East is hosting the event. He speaks with MPB's Desiree Frazier.
There is some discouragement from individuals about going into education like never before. We are one of the few professions, if you will, that requires you to have 20 years of experience on the first day of school. I mean, you know, the same standards, the same you have to perform. And so though I think we're doing a good job with professional development, it is still a slower process. So I think that you have students that are looking into the future and understanding how much work goes into it. And then that brings on the pay factor and the chance for promotion once you're there. I don't think initial pay is a hindrance as much as once I'm there and I prove myself, how can I make extra dollars in my profession and not just be years of service? Can I mentor someone? Can I do some more after school work? Can I do things to actually increase my pay other than just time and attendance?
Salaries in Mississippi are lower than the Southeastern average and nationally. Is that correct?
That is correct. And we need to do, and I think there's a great effort to do something about it, and we just need to put our heads together and find the best pathway to do it. And those are the conversations that we're looking to have in this teacher shortage conference, or what are solutions to making those things happen.
What are you hearing from teachers that have left the field, maybe retired or just decided they were going to leave?
So I can speak only for Gulfport on this issue, but I think a lot of teachers that are reaching retirement age are leaving. The changes we're making, the rigor, quite frankly, is different. The need to be trained in more areas than just a subject area for teachers, I think, is finding them going other places. At the end of the day, also, this has always been rewarding work, but it's also hard work. And so I think that there are those that try in and they understand the rewarding piece. But the day-to-day importance of lesson planning and student preparation and building relationships guides people to other directions.
And looking at the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on educators, in your estimation, what are you finding with that?
I know that we put together some great plans in our first attempt in an international pandemic to educate children. And you know that anytime you devise plans, you think you have all the bases covered. I think that if we were to roll the tape back, we would do some things differently to help preserve teachers. One of the things that we learned here in Gulfport is that we tried to do virtual and face-to-face at the same time, where a teacher may have had 10 students face-to-face in a classroom and 10 virtually. that didn't work. That was very stressful on the students and the teachers. So I think that coming out of the COVID-19, the protocols we've tried to set in place, not health-wise, but educational-wise, we've learned so much. And I think that teachers in their best days are going to give you everything they have to make something work for the benefit of children. And in doing that, teachers are tired.
Coming up, or excuse me, that was Glenn East. He's superintendent of schools in Gulfport. Coming up, a conversation with one of the men behind a new documentary on Mississippi artist Walter Anderson. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and depends on the support of listeners like you. If you can, please donate today at mpbonline.org. And thanks.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. Watercolorist Walter Anderson, known to some as the South's greatest artist, is the subject of a new hour-long documentary premiering tonight at 7 p.m. on MPB TV. Anthony Thaxton, who along with Robert St. John made the film, tells us he's long felt a personal connection to Anderson and his work.
As a young person growing up on the coast, I used to work on, we lived in the Lakeshore and Waveland area near Bay St. Louis growing up, and I worked on shrimp boats in the summer. So I was always drawn to coastal things, and Walter Anderson's art really spoke to me from an early age. And then Robert St. John and Wyatt Waters and I filmed at the museum and just had a wonderful visit with Walter's son, and it just really drew us into wanting to do something more in depth on Walter Anderson.
What is it about his art that drew you in?
It's not only is it the wonderful colors and the design sense, but also primarily at the beginning, it was the subject matter for me. It really spoke to me. Here was an artist saying it's all right to paint crabs and fish and shrimp and these sorts of things, the things we saw every day. And it was okay to paint these things. And it made me want to capture my surroundings and to really experience life in a different kind of way.
He had a real love affair with Horn Island. What did that stem from?
Well, I think it stemmed for him. It was a refuge where he could strip away everything that was unimportant, all of the duties and responsibility, everything, but all of the noise of life, and he could totally commune with nature, be at one with Providence, and just really experience nature through his art. And later in his life, it became much more about the process than the final product. And I think Horn Island was the place where he really could experience that to the fullest.
You had access to a lot of resources as well as interviews with family and others. Tell us about that. What was your greatest source, not only of inspiration, but of actual content for this?
Well, it really was kind of an unprecedented kind of diving into the family. The book and the film both really are so full of family stories and poignant memories personal. It's a very personal, intimate look into his life and art, I think, in a way that really never has been done in quite such a personal manner. At the heart, it's the story of a father and his children, and we even have an interview from the Department of Archives and History featuring Sissy's voice, his wife. So we're getting these deep personal reflections of Anderson in a way that just hasn't been presented. And I'm excited for people to hear. Marshall Ramsey, others have said that it really is making them look at Walter Anderson in a different way. And that's kind of what we were hoping to do.
What is the size of his portfolio?
That's a hard question, because he worked all of the time. So when he died, they found in the little room, a chest that had over 2000 watercolors. So he did 2000 drawings alone on Don Quixote, just pen and ink drawings. So he just drew all of the time, but so many of those were lost in Katrina. So much of the work was damaged that it's really hard to say. I'm not even sure the family knows. And so many of the people on the coast that owned Walter Anderson paintings lost their homes, so they lost their originals. So it's a hard question, but we were able to find photographs and records of some of these works and present them in the film, even though some of the paintings don't even exist anymore.
What is his place in the annals of art history?
I think we really don't know how Walter Anderson's place will play out ultimately in art history. In 2003, the Smithsonian did an exhibit of his work on the 100th anniversary of his birth, and it was a large exhibit, and not just anyone gets a show at the Smithsonian. So he has had a bunch of recognition, but in Walter's life, recognition wasn't what he was after. So it's kind of been up to us to do the films, to do the books, to get the word out there. And the family has done a wonderful job of trying to get his work out there and the message that we all can work together and make the world a more beautiful place, whether that be through block prints or watercolors or just our lives.
Anthony Thaxton is the filmmaker behind Walter Anderson, The Extraordinary Life and Art of the Islander. It airs tonight on MPB TV at 7 o'clock. Thank you so much, Anthony.
Thank you so much, Karen.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Klein from Fix It 101. If you ever thought about changing the doorknob or fixing a leaky faucet, some jobs just aren't that difficult, and yes, you can do it. If you want to find out how to do those things, listen to Fix It 101, podcast everywhere.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. Rough Tactics is a new work of nonfiction from the University Press of Mississippi. It tracks an unlikely decades-long alliance between white politicians and black performers in the Jim Crow South. Mark A. Johnson wrote the book.
White politicians wanted the black musicians at their campaigns and rallies and parades, these sort of spectacular events that were part of politics, because it helped them reconnect their white supremacist version of the Democratic Party to the Old South. It allowed them to portray harmonious race relations, even when that was not the case, which justified then their white supremacist policies. The black participation at these events helped reinforce the idea that African Americans preferred things this way, consented to this sort of inferior status, and respected white people. So with that in mind, why did so many black musicians participate in these events if they ended up reinforcing those stereotypes or those myths? I argue that they took the job for a variety of reasons. On one hand, they took those jobs because they kind of had to. They got paid. They had access to mainstream white audiences so they could showcase their talents. In fact, W.C. Handy talks about that after one particularly racist incident. He kind of laughs it off and says, well, we got to showcase our talent and made a few bucks and had a couple laughs at the guy's expense when we were out of earshot. So on one hand, they take those gigs for those sorts of reasons. And in a way, that resists everything that white supremacists had been trying to deny them anyway.
It was interesting that there were times that black musicians played and they were actually mocking or humiliating the politician they were playing for. And I hope you'll share the story with us briefly about Tennessee Governor John Buchanan and a parade that was held in 1892.
Yes. So in 1892, the Tennessee governor, who had some white supremacist policies and had supported disfranchisement measures, started his reelection campaign as part of the campaign. Yeah, he went to Clarksville, Tennessee. They arranged for him to parade from the train station to his speaking engagement. Along the way, they arranged for black musicians to lead the parade. And the musicians took the opportunity to harass him with funeral songs. So that's just one example of the other end of this resistance.
Did anybody pick up on the fact that they were doing that, that they were playing funeral songs?
Yes, they all picked up on it, and they told this story. The story gets picked up in the national press. And the people retelling this story, they make it clear what happened, that the black musicians played these funeral songs. On one hand, that gives these African Americans credit, right, for their political awareness, and their political behavior. But they also cast a little bit of doubt on whether the black musicians understood what they were doing. They do that because it helps, right, the white politicians save face, and it reinforces the stereotype of kind of the feckless, naturally talented black musician that maybe doesn't know any better. So even in a case like this, both sides can still kind of get what they want out of the situation.
Do you think that this time period and this practice of black musicians playing for white politicians changed perceptions or made a difference in politics?
Maybe this behavior didn't change a whole lot. White supremacists continue to get elected. They continue to strengthen disfranchisement measures. But they did consider the spectacular part of politics an important part of politics. They believed that presence at the polls, even by disfranchised groups, including white women, made a difference, that it could sway votes, persuade people, and testify to a party's strength. So I think in those ways, this behavior did make an impact. For example, in this time period, Democrats control pretty much everything in local government, state legislatures, national offices from the South. In fact, they call it the Solid South. But I think that these sort of performances, especially the ones where they take the opportunity to overtly harass or humiliate the opposition, reminded not only the politicians, but everyone gathered there of their presence and their place in the citizenry and their potential political power. And I think it reminded everyone that even though white supremacy seemed all-powerful, it was never as all-powerful as white politicians hoped it was.
Mark A. Johnson is the author of Rough Tactics, Black Performance in Political Spectacles, 1877 to 1932. Mark, thank you very much.
Yes, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Coming up, a look at vaccine disparities amongst young people in the Deep South. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. Kids ages 5 to 11 will soon be able to get Pfizer's COVID vaccine, and the CDC is urging parents to get them the shot. Vaccination rates still lag across the Gulf South. When it comes to uptake among 12 to 17-year-olds, some national studies show that white teenagers are getting vaccinated more than black teens. But in our region, that's not the case. Shalina Chatlani of the Gulf States Newsroom has the story.
It's a Friday night in Mississippi, which means high school football.
And for the Madison Central Jaguars, number one, C.J. Barney.
The Mustangs from the city of Jackson are playing against the Jaguars in Madison County. The competing schools are just 20 minutes apart. One is predominantly black, and athletes are required to get vaccinated or tested regularly. The other, which is mostly white, doesn't have that mandate. Parents on the sidelines had a wide range of thoughts on that.
I want him to be safe.
Erin Phillips, who is black and vaccinated, said many people in her community have died of COVID, so she's glad there's a mandate.
Football is a full contact sport. You know, you're breathing hard, you're falling on each other, pushing each other. You know, I just wanted him to be more safe than without the vaccination.
Amy Palmer, who was there rooting for her grandson on the other team, says no one in her family is vaccinated. She says most people in her family got COVID and were okay.
So why get it? I mean, 5 to 11-year-olds is unnecessary.
Data acquired from health departments across the Gulf South show black teenagers are getting vaccinated at roughly 1.5 times the rate of white teenagers. But decisions are nuanced. Ken Ball is working the grill at the game. He's white and vaccinated. He got all his kids the shot, even though there's no mandate at their school.
My mom's a school teacher, and she's in her 70s. And what I don't want is my kids to kill my mom.
But, he said, he believes it should be up to parents. In fact, that was a common theme here. For most of the black parents, getting their kids the vaccine was a no-brainer, and they supported mandates. While many white parents didn't want to be forced, even if they did get their kids vaccinated. Politics and a sense of liberty do play a role in vaccinations in the South, says Dr. Anita Henderson.
A white mom, she wanted to talk about it. But what she told me was she and her husband were shamed for wanting to get their children vaccinated. But I haven't had that conversation with any of my black families.
Henderson is a Mississippi pediatrician and head of the state's American Academy of Pediatrics. She says black children are nearly three times more likely to die from a severe case of COVID-19 because of issues like underlying health conditions. There are also practical issues like childcare.
Getting vaccinated helps to keep kids in school. And so that may also be something that black parents are paying closer attention to, perhaps.
At the beginning of the vaccine rollout, black communities were under-vaccinated. Now, black residents are ahead of white residents in vaccinations across Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama.
Yeah, I'm actually not surprised by that.
Thomas LeViste is a dean of public health at Tulane University in Louisiana. He's also on the state's health equity task force.
Much of the vaccine hesitancy in the black community has been around distrust.
LeViste says health departments across the South consciously worked to address that distrust. They worked with black churches and community leaders.
For whites, the vaccine hesitancy is more likely to be around a political identity. And if not getting vaccinated is a part of what makes up your sense of who you are, it's much harder to deal with someone's identity.
But he says the vaccination rate for black teenagers, though a win, is a small one, as vaccination rates across the Gulf South are still some of the lowest in the country overall.
So blacks are doing better, but they're still not doing as well as they should. Whites are dramatically underperforming, and it's a problem.
Some experts worry the gap could persist as 5 to 11-year-olds become eligible for the vaccine. For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Shalina Chutlani.
This story was produced by the Gulf States Newsroom, a collaboration between WWNO in New Orleans, WBHM in Birmingham, Mississippi Public Broadcasting, and NPR.
Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Edition podcast from MPB News and MPB Think Radio. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already, and if your app lets you, leave a comment or review. We really do appreciate it. Remember, you can always get in touch with MPB News on Facebook and Twitter, and fresh episodes of the podcast are posted every weekday morning. I'm Karen Brown. Thanks for listening. This is Mississippi Edition from MPB Think Radio.